welcome to Astrology for Artists. My name is Eric Francis, your astrologer in residence, or astrologer and artist in residence, and I'm here with a message and a method and some ideas about the way in which we Westerners in particular, can use, explore an idea of accessing the core creativity that we contain as a means of healing our lives. Most of us have some healing to do in life, and a lot of it is healing from life itself, from the experience of being on the planet at this time with so many odd stresses, so many unusual demands placed on our energy, in our time, in our resources, and all of that having a tendency to take us out of our center. And the concept of applying, using a kind of art therapy, which I think, by the way, is going to be the therapy of the future. The idea of that, as I see it, is to engage oneself in something closer to the center of what you are, something closer to the heart of the matter, of what it means to be a person alive and participating on the planet at this time. There is so much about our lives that's becoming automated, robotic, pre-scripted, controlled, that I think that it may be the only way to disengage from all of that is to retrieve something closer to the center of who you are, to possibly return to a spirit of a previous time in your life, a time closer to the consciousness of childhood when there was a kind of a mysterious beauty and intrigue and curiosity about practically everything. And additionally, I'm aware from having worked as a consultant for many years that there are a great many people who have an aspiration or who had an aspiration to be an actual artist of some kind, to create something of beauty and of devotion, and that was somehow lost or left behind or subverted by circumstance. And so I know that I'm speaking additionally to a condition of life in our culture and perhaps in many cultures where it's not just the creative aspect of a person, the self-creative and the imaginal aspect of who you are is compromised, but there was also some way that you may have wanted to extend yourself and express yourself, perhaps through music or pottery or painting or drawing or filmmaking or photography or music. And it is so often those desires, those aspirations that are damaged by, for example, early caregivers, parents who lacked any sense of vision, parents who were jealous about what their children were, the kind of unvarnished desire to be and to express that they had taken from them, that they had somehow been convinced to leave behind, to go to accounting school and not go to music school. The stories are legion. There are endless stories when you start to listen to humanity. You could get a group of your friends together for dinner and go around the table and probably share stories of subverted creativity and curiosity that could go on for hours on end, and perhaps even discover that you could write a book about this. And this has been done in some ways. I mean, the field of expressive arts therapy is becoming a real thing. I think well respected and recognized as a viable, interesting, exciting mode of connecting with oneself, which is what therapy is about trusting existence, which is what therapy is about. And in addition, in my own life, I owe a great deal to Julia Cameron, the author of The Artist's Way, who took a recovery model, a 12-step recovery model, and basically developed it into a 12-week exploratory program of recovering one's core essential beingness through creative process, through mainly writing and then other extended or art projects extended off of that. And so many have been down this road, and it is still elusive. It is still challenging. I'm aware of the challenges on a very deep level. I know how difficult it is, or how difficult it can be, for example, for a person with adult responsibility and with adult demands on their time to be able to take the energy and the bandwidth and the space, it could be physical space or emotional space, and return to a center of their being. And at the same time, as adults, the brain is allegedly not as elastic. Our neurology is more set. People tend to become set in their ways, and all of the whole idea process around relating to the world in an inquisitive and expressive way has largely been stifled. And that set in one's ways thing is often about an expectation of the world being a certain way and not being any other way, and then it is difficult to find some other way. So I often joke, it's easy if you're 14 years old and you really want to learn how to play guitar and you don't really have much else going on, and you figure out at 14 that it's more important than swim team and football, and so you just do it. You have a lot of time and not a lot of responsibility, and your mind is younger. There's less in there, and it's easier. And so if you're 50 and you want to pick up piano or a guitar or a paintbrush, or you want to learn creative writing, there are a whole selection of challenges. And I intend to address those as best I can. The way that I've been developing this material is on two main tracks. One is, first, not astrological. It is an association of ideas that I've set out on two pages in a gigantic sketchbook that I'm using for illustration practice, and then also now for painting practice, and doing what I call color tests of inks and acrylic inks and India inks. And so I've got a big two-page spread with ideas here that I've been collecting. And at the same time, parallel to that, I've been working with the astrology and looking for ideas from the astrology that are associated with the retrograde of Venus in the sign, both in Virgo and then in Leo, and then the ingress of Jupiter from Leo to Virgo. So there's a lot going on the cusp between the fifth sign Leo and the sixth sign Virgo. And though I use a number of different approaches to the houses, for the sake of this discussion, or at least part of this discussion, let's imagine that Leo really is about the fifth house and Virgo really is about the sixth house. I have some interesting alternative ways to think about that astrologically, but this will work as an illustration. And I think, by the way, that astrology works best as an illustration and then second best as a divinatory tool, as a way to dance with the random quality of existence and get back something through the opening, the mind opening that's created through accessing a random method of getting information, right? In theory, the movements of the planets, many, many planets, should be random. And yet we look to that for information. The selection of tarot cards from a tarot card deck should be random, but we look for wisdom and information through that. And the moment of tarot and the moment of astrology is the random moment chosen to look at a chart, to look at the transits. It could be your birth time. It could be another time in your life. And that random moment produces something of an intelligence that subverts what has come before, basically. It allows a newness in, a fresh approach, and a look at what's never been seen before. For example, I mean, a tarot card spread, you've never seen that spread before. I mean, there's a finite number of 10 card spreads you can get from a 78 card deck, but it's quite a high factorial. It verges on infinite number of combinations. And as I often tell tarot students, no tarot spread is in any tarot book that you ever read. So you can read the books all you want. You can study the meanings of the cards all you want. And you can study certain formulas for certain placements of cards next to each other. But then you pretty much have to let that all go when you're looking at this absolutely, completely random pattern. And so in using divination, we're allowing some of that in. And then also, going back to the fifth house, sixth house thing, there is a model that we can borrow from, a kind of organization of reality, a description of reality that has been passed down through the ages and is always left to the next generation for interpretation. That's always basically given to us now in the moment to interpret the way that we can and need to and want to and must interpret in the world that we live in today. And so I'm going to look at some movement of planets through this structure of the signs and houses and describe something of how in this section, in a kind of a broad theory, and then in the sections for the astrological signs and rising signs, more specifically, how we can apply that. But I want to say this, that of all the 12 sign readings that I've ever done, I suspect that this one will be the one where every one of the 12 signs and this introduction and possibly a conclusion recording are applicable to everyone. So I suggest you start with your sun sign and then listen to your rising sign. Find that out. It's easy to find out your rising sign if you know your birth time, even close to your birth time. And then check your moon sign. And then that leaves at least 9 signs. And I'm going to suggest that you dip into those randomly to apply the experiment of randomness. One of the notes I have on my big 2-page spread here, which I'm going to take a picture of or scan or something like that and let you see kind of what I'm working from, is about the use of divination as a way to subvert rationality and logic and to bring a new logic in to the equation. One of the people who I think is one of the great bringers out of people's creativity, recognizing that you can't really give someone creativity, but you can help them bring out their creativity and you can give them ideas that get themselves out of their own way and collaborate a little and mingle some viewpoints and come up with something new and different, and potentially even original. One of the best people at that in our lifetimes is a guy named Brian Eno, musician, music producer, collaborator with some of the great artistic acts of our time. There is bound to be at least one, possibly two or three of the music acts that Brian has worked with that you absolutely love. And so you may very well be acquainted with Brian Eno's work, but may not know how that happened. I'm always surprised when I find out the next person who he kind of assisted in birthing in a transformational process. And before I was a diviner, before I was working as a coach to artists as an astrologer, and before I was working as doing professional divination work, I was aware of the work of Brian Eno with Talking Heads. That was my point of contact with Brian Eno's work. And the second place was with the band U2. And I remember when the first album that Brian did with Talking Heads came out. That was called Fear of Music. And I don't know if you were around when that came out or you were, you know, lucky enough to hear that when it was a new thing, but it was monstrous. It was absolutely overwhelmingly beautiful and powerful with the most ginormous what the fuck is this and how did it get so amazing over it. And then I started hanging over and then I started to make the connection that this person, Brian Eno, who I knew actually previously through Music for Airports and the Ambient series, had worked, had collaborated with Talking Heads and created something. So I think I might have just said that the first time I had heard of Eno was with Talking Heads. I'll tell you that was the first time I've heard of him as a collaborator and producer of someone else's work. Previously, I had encountered his work as a teenager when I read a little article in Scientific American that this guy had come out with an album called Music for Airports that was designed to be played in airports, and it would calm people down and chill them out. And I got that and on an LP, and I played it many, many, many times and did a lot of tripping to this album, which is practically silent. I mean, it's there's probably sets the record for white space in a recording. And then, well, I went through a bunch of his other, followed him for a while, and then he merged with Talking Heads, and then Fear of Music came out. Now, the point I'm getting at with this is, apart from how I have found that listening to Eno does things to my mind and may do things to your mind that bring out that inner artist, that bring out that kind of hot, molten, creative, experimental spirit, however it manifests for you, but something like that, is that when I read a book by Eno, rather about Talking Heads, not by Eno makes an appearance in the book because he was so influential in Talking Heads. I forget the name of the author, but it's a biography of Talking Heads, and they tell the story of the band, which comes out of an art school called the Rhode Island School of Design. And one of my favorite rants, and I give it in the edition of Planet Waves FM that came out yesterday. That would be on the little computer. Tell me what day it is. 21st, and I think in the third section, is that Eno works with a device called Oblique Strategies that he invented. He had a collaborator. I forget the person's name. I didn't know there was a collaborator till very recently when I looked up the project and try to find out if this Oblique Strategies thing was actually available for sale. And I found a couple of copies in England and got one. And what this is it's a set of ideas on cards, right? So they're printed on cards. Turns out it's actually very nice, high quality production. What was I expecting? I don't know. But they are basically ideas for what to do when you are at a blocked, basically when you're creatively blocked or when you're at a crossroads of some kind and you need to know how to handle the circumstances, how to handle the situation that you're in. So today, on July 22nd, these cards arrived from England. Amy Elliott was my contact in England who got them and then sent me one of the two sets I got, and I gave her the other one for her troubles. And so also today I'm like, how am I going to start this? I have to do the introduction and 12 signs and get the music right. And oh my God, I'm panicking. And it has to be good because this is a really great idea and I want to do it justice. And people are expecting this. And as usual, people have pre-ordered and, you know, so forth and so on. So in a minor panic, I've got, for the first time in my life, I didn't write down the time, unfortunately, but I've got a pack of Oblique Strategies cards in my hands today for the first time. I heard about them 25 years-ish ago. Wondering how to do this thing that you're listening to now. And I think, well, what better to do than to pull my first Oblique Strategies card ever? And so I reach in to the, I shuffle the thing, it's 100 cards. I shuffle these nice, hefty, nice size, the perfect size cards in this beautiful little black box. And I pull out a card and open my eyes and eagerly look at it. And it says, make a brick, not a wall. I only had to think about that for about 1.1 seconds, and I thought, yeah, that's it. Now, what's he mean by that? What he means by that, in case you haven't figured it out yet, is don't worry about the whole thing. Make a component. Start with part. Make a nice part. Could be anything, right? Make a brick, not a wall. That's oblique, right? That could apply to anything. And I got that the thing to do with astrology for artists is do one section, do the introduction, get the introduction down, see where that goes. I have enough time. I know how long it takes to do these things, and they usually turn out better than I'm planning anyway, and really my problem was I was getting in my own way, and all of my telecommunications went down today. Modem and the phone and my backup modem was down. And so when I finished a big project, I had to spend the next 3 hours basically doing something I pretty much usually refuse to do, which is errands, going to Verizon and Time Warner Cable and running around and like basically burning half of a workday replacing all these devices. But all the while I'm thinking, make a brick, not a wall. So Eno, in his brilliance, in his brilliance of working with people who we think are the most brilliant people, such as David Byrne, who I think is one of the most brilliant people crawling around the planet right now. David Bowie, another one of my candidates for one of the most brilliant people crawling around the planet. In his wisdom of doing this, he applies a method of divination. And that method of divination involves the choice of a random strategy and seeing how that fits the scenario. And I know what some of these cards say. I've read about them, and some of them will say like switch instruments, you know. So if it's a band and everyone, you know, this person's on bass, that person's on guitar, that person's on drums. Well, that person plays little bass, that person plays little drums, that person plays little guitar. Let's see what comes out if we pass the instruments around and try a different approach. One of the cards, I think, says, take a break. Another card advises to reverse the process that you're doing. And in my use of divination, one of its methods is to kind of play that game of creativity using random patterns and random ideas and random cards. Another connection between divination and my appreciation of and my practice of art was that I learned to look at a painting or any piece of visual art by learning to read tarot cards. Long before I had any real appreciation of art, I had taken art history. I thought it was interesting, did well in it, and was amazed by it. But really, still, I was at that place where I didn't quite understand the language of art. It was tarot that taught me the language of art. It was tarot that taught me that visual expression is a set of symbols, an intentional expression. And it was a photo mentor, of which I've had many really good ones. Somebody by the name of Kelly Cowan, who's been one of the really heavy-duty visual art, particularly photography mentors that I have. And I went through early in the Book of Blue work that I was doing, one of the projects I've done. It was Kelly who pretty much pushed me into understanding the idea that every element of the photo is an intentional inclusion, that there is nothing about the photo, the final statement that is made, that is not intentional. Now, there is a corollary to that, which is how often the most magnificent photo comes out of some random accident. You know, the camera's out of focus, or the f-stop is wrong, or you're pointing it across the room at the wrong thing and you push the button. Or you take 20 photos of the same thing and one comes out absolutely differently and you weren't planning that difference. And so often with art, there is that discipline of focusing intentionality and of making choices. Like in photography, a lot of what you're doing is you choose the final photo. This is the part of photography that is the most transparent, right, to criticism and understanding of photos, is that when you look at a photo that a photographer presents you with, the chances are they took quite a few photos of that subject and that scene and picked one. Well, which one did they pick? And it's always interesting to see what used to be called the contact sheet, to see all the photos that surround the photo. And sometimes you can find interesting things out from there. And sometimes someone else looking at your contact sheet will see things that, at least that I don't see. I work with a photo editor who was also working on Book of Blue, named Paloma, who would look at my contact sheet and I would say fairly well that 90% of the photos she chose would not be ones that I chose, but they were good photos, and I would never have even seen them. And so this is arguing for, describing the appreciation of intention, of disciplined intention, and at the same time honoring the random process, what just happens. As I often tell young photographers, you know, charge the battery and show up and follow the light. That's photography. And then you get lucky. No matter how much planning you do, if you charge the battery, show up and follow the light, you set yourself up to get lucky. And then at the right time, there is space for the inclusion of collaboration on some level. There's the space to bring someone else into the relationship. So I want to give a very brief two more items in this introduction. So it may go on for a while, and I'd rather just leave it as one continuous tape that will go for a little bit longer. I want to talk about the cusp of Leo and Virgo, which for our purposes, we're talking about as the cusp of the fifth and sixth signs, and therefore the fifth and sixth houses. And I want to just remind you, there's other ways to look at the houses. Theme of Monday, if you've been listening, is one of them. It turns everything 90 degrees. First house is Cancer, but let's think of the first house as Aries. Therefore, the fifth sign is the fifth house, sixth sign, sixth house. And consider what's going on the cusp of the fifth and the sixth right now. So one of my theories of the houses is that, first of all, every house represents an environment. And then every house cusp represents a special environment where there is a kind of a transitional area, or where there is a meeting point between these two seemingly different themes and different environments that's part of the gradient. Because if you follow the story of the houses, the first house describes something, and the second house develops that, and the third develops that, and then the fourth, and so forth, to all the way around to the 12th house, there's a story. But at the transition between the chapters, something interesting is happening. There is something that is I think often overlooked by most astrologers, though some have alluded to it, but I have really not seen it explained very well. And I think, therefore, that each of the house cusps, and so for our purposes, sign cusps, represents a special environment. Now, I can use an example from marine biology. Typically, there's saltwater environments and there's freshwater environments. In a saltwater environment, the job of the critter is to keep the salt out. In the freshwater environment, the job of the critter is to keep the salt in. Because the thing that rules marine biology is the law of diffusion. Things diffuse from a greater concentration to a lesser concentration. So if a critter is in a salt environment, it's going to be soaked in salt. The salt's going to try to get into the area of lesser concentration. If a creature is in a freshwater environment, its body necessarily contains salts that keep everything running. But those salts are going to want to diffuse into the freshwater environment. And so when you get to a house cusp, there's this diffusion effect that is a little bit like what a creature in a brackish environment has to do. So there's salt and then there's fresh, but then there's the really interesting environment called the brackish environment, where it is sometimes salt water, sometimes fresh water, or a continuously changing blend of fresh water and salt water. And some creatures like salmon start in fresh water, end up in salt water, and then return to fresh water to spawn. So think of the house cusps as a kind of a brackish estuary, a place where there is a unique environment in all the world that describes the mixture, the combination of different influences that produce something really different, new, and perhaps either unusual or necessary. So the fifth house is an interesting house. It's one of the easiest houses to use to teach the houses. So the fifth house involves play, pleasure, the childlike state of mind, the childlike approach to sex, all forms of creativity, pleasure being an extension of that, or that being an extension of pleasure, experimentation, gambling, like games of chance, oblique strategies, the element of risk, and therefore necessarily courage. So you've got this environment that I think of really as the art studio of the Zodiac. It is a place where the rules are suspended, and you might well walk around on the couch with shoes on, or sleep with your clothes on, or get paint all over the kitchen table, or do things you wouldn't normally be allowed to do. So, for example, my art studio currently is my dining room, which I'm in right now, which is doesn't look like any kind of a formal dining room you've ever seen. And I've got this nice new kitchen table. It's only a couple of years old, and it's a beautiful thing with looks like a marble surface and all this stuff. And I'm doing a lot of painting on this. And if I were to worry about the surface of this table, I would not have any fun painting. I would have to have newspaper down and getting the newspaper on things. Then I have all this newspaper I'd have to throw out. I'm not worried. The table is all marked up with various forms of paint and gesso and various substances, and I'm perfectly happy to have that table looking like that. The normal rules are suspended for the purpose of creative experimentation and therefore risk-taking, all for the purpose of experimentation, curiosity, and pleasure. So most of the themes that we need to restore some sense of core contact with the self-creative self-creative element of self can be found in the fifth house. And I'll go over them again. I probably missed a few, but you might want to either jot them down or listen again. But the fifth begins with pleasure. And by the way, children are a factor of the fifth house, including when you're reading a natal chart from the fatalistic standpoint, whether the person will have children. And then additionally, there is curiosity, risk-taking, games, risk meaning games of chance, things of a daring nature, like bungee jumping. Creative risks are included. The sensation of experimentation, curiosity. And then all of that contained in what I think of as a kind of creative space, an art studio. So the art studio might have a couch, it might have a cot or a bed, it might have a kitchen, but it's going to be a different kind of couch or cot or bed or kitchen because it's going to be associated with the process of curiosity and experimentation. So those are the two: pleasure, curiosity, experimentation, doing things for their own sake. This is the essence of the fifth house. In a word, fun, but it's a special kind of fun. It's not just the kind of fun of like, the amusement park might be included in the fifth house. For my purposes, it doesn't exist. So the fifth is this creative, self-creative space, and it tells you a lot about people to look at their fifth house. And when we're looking at the solar houses, for example, looking at the sign Virgo, considering what the fifth solar house, counting just the whole signs, landing the fifth sign, that tells you a lot about Virgo, that there's Capricorn in the fifth house, right? And Pluto's there now. And so when we get to Virgo, I'm going to talk about the presence of Pluto in Capricorn, in the fifth house, in the background of what it's like to have Capricorn connected with that house that's supposed to be like Leo. Okay, so that's one house we're talking about. And the other house we're talking about is the sixth, which is like Virgo. And that is the space of service, of healing, of work. That's true. But I think of it as the house of work where you get lost in your work, when the sixth is really alive, when the sixth house is really happening, there is a kind of a time slip that occurs in the sixth house where, you know, we've all had this happen where you, it's Friday night and it's 9:30 at night and you're not sure if you're up to something, but you really want to do it. So you say, all right, I'll do this for a few minutes. And then you start doing it. And then you look at the clock and it's like 2 a.m. and you don't know where the time went, but you sure did have fun and you sure did do something that was interesting. And there is that sensation of time not being a burden anymore. So in the sixth, the burden of time is lifted when the sixth is in tune, when we're working with it, and we're set free from that. And there is the full engagement of oneself with one's experience. And by the way, it was originally, almost 20 years ago, Barbara Hand Cloud that pointed out that little clue about the sixth house, that time phenomenon, that has been so helpful to me in figuring out the nature of the sixth house. And by the way, it is often the little clue that helps you understand what a house is. And one little clue I got from Patrick Walker, the person without whom I would be very unlikely to be an astrologer, is that it's all in the houses. All of astrology is in the houses. And I think that even if you don't believe in astrology, which you might, but even if you don't, studying the houses and the pattern of subjects that they make tells us a lot, as we are discovering right now. So fifth house has this fun curiosity experimentation theme. The sixth house has a work, service, devotion, also well-being theme. And that property of time just kind of slipping away when we're working in there and really enjoying work. Serious play, as I like to call it. Where the two meet is a kind of a brackish estuary where we might find the whole theme of expressive art therapy or using art as therapy, as a means of healing, to explore creative process in some way, as a way of making contact with your creative self, as a way of experimenting your way to a new kind of inner freedom that gives you the, where you more accurately give yourself the freedom to experiment with color, just to experiment with color, not to be a great painter, but to see what interesting colors you can get. And I would say, by the way, that the first element of healing on that fifth, sixth cusp line is about suspending the need to do something well and doing it for the sake of doing it, just to see what happens. That state of experimentation is vital to working the healing attribute of creativity and doing real creative recovery work. Now, this might not work so well if you are under the pressure to perform or to produce. And so I want to be clear that what I'm talking about in this whole series, though it's probably going to come up at some point, but what I'm getting at is not about how to take the thing that you do and make it into a source of income or a business. I've covered that in a previous report called Good as Gold. In this discussion, my intention is to really experiment with, play with art for art's sake, but really art for the sake of contacting your inner life, your inner passion, your curiosity, and your desire to experiment, and your desire to connect with your self-creation. So anyway, the Leo Virgo cusp has been a very busy place lately. First of all, there's this point that I may be the only astrologer who uses called Trans-Pluto, very slowly creeping between the last degree of Leo and the first degree of Virgo. It has taken years. It is such a slow point. It takes 75 years to go through one sign that it has taken something like 4 years possibly more of dancing between the last degree of Leo and the first degree of Virgo. So that's one thing that's been happening. And currently it's in the first degree of Virgo. The second thing is that Venus has slowed down and has entered Virgo, where it is stationing right now. It's going to station on the 25th, and therefore is spending a long time in the first degree Virgo, conjunct this thing called Trans-Pluto, and it's about to retrograde back into Leo. So it's as if it went through Leo, which it's done basically since June, and then just arrived in Virgo. It's going to stay there for about another week, go back into Leo, and stay there till October 8th, when it re-enters Virgo. So there's Venus dancing back and forth between the 5th and 6th, emphasizing that meeting place. It's like it's swimming in this estuary between the 5th house theme and the 6th house theme. Okay, then Jupiter is going to move its way over the Leo to Virgo line. That happens very soon as well, if I'm not mistaken. That happens in August. By August 15th, the chart that I'm using for this whole reading, I'm using the Venus-Sun conjunction in Leo. Jupiter is already in Virgo at that point, so it gets in there in early August. It doesn't move all that fast, so it's well into the first degree of Virgo, still conjunct Trans-Pluto. So that's a lot of activity to have on one little imaginary line of the zodiac, and that's one of the sources of inspiration, of conceptual inspiration that I got to work this whole territory of astrology for artists. So what we have here is the conscious use of, and a kind of unusual level of access of, that curious, experimental, childlike approach to existence, where color and form exist for their own sake, and the healing approach, and the there's a healing approach to the sixth, and there's also the idea of technique. Okay, now this is pretty important, and I think I'm going to end on this message, and then give a quick rundown of my main talking points in kind of a part two of the introduction, since we are flexible around here. Okay, so the technique thing is possibly a real creativity killer, because the technique thing can come immediately with the judgment of I'm not good enough. I'm not doing this well enough. I have no creativity. I'm not really creative. That usually comes from people who will say that they are bored. So by the way, one of the first things you want to kind of go after and resolve is this very unusual state of mind called boredom. And technique can have that boredom-inducing thing because it can have a way of taking over the experimental part, the experimental bit. And one of the things I suggest is that you experiment your way into technique rather than taking a kind of a paint-by-numbers approach. I would say that for our purposes and for most purposes, it would be altogether more helpful to throw a bucket of paint at the wall and see what happens than it would be to take a paint-by-numbers approach where the little thing tells you exactly which paint number to put in that exact little space. Or if you're going to do paint-by-numbers, you know, subtract 3 from every number and see what you get when you do that, rather than just following the paint-by-number thing. Because the obsession with technique first can have a way of snuffing out the element of experimentation, the element of creativity that is basically born of accident, that is, the luck factor, basically. But the luck factor happens again when you show up and you know, mix the paints and see what happens and try and experiment and see if you can learn the art of not judging. One of the things about Trans-Pluto that's keying me into this, apart from the fact that it's in Virgo, and that Virgo contains a lot of self-critical things, right? Self-critical ideas, and Trans-Pluto amplifies that, is that it is often parents who put that onto us, who say, you know, that you're not good enough or you'll never make money at that. I mean, I'm one of these people who my father told me I'd never make money as a writer. I might be a good writer, but I'd never make money as a writer. I mean, what the fuck did he know? Seriously. So he never did. And we all have these stories. I mean, part of my dad's story is that when he graduated Brooklyn College in 1963, 52 years ago, he wanted to go into television. But he made up his mind that there were no jobs left in television. Now, if there were 4 TV channels in New York City in 1963, I'd really be surprised. I don't even think that Channel 13 existed in 1963, our flagship PBS station, WNET. That was a self-critical choice projected onto the world as a form of limitation, and now there are, you know, 1,000 TV channels, probably many more, depending on if you, you know, get the expanded service with, you know, that you can watch all the Chinese channels and all that stuff. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? So, Trans-Pluto, in that first degree of Virgo, is a caution against putting overemphasis on technique. And so I am suggesting that the thing to do is experiment and to consider all of your self-creative endeavors a kind of a self-creative experiment. And that you experiment your way into a technique that works for you, and then you experiment your way into another technique that works for you and see where you get. And use the concept technique for, you know, pretty much anything that you want. Okay, so that's good. I've been going on now for 49 minutes and 21 seconds. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a short break. And then I'm going to read you some thoughts. I've got my, you know, random thoughts on the page here that I've been collecting for a while. And just riff on some of those ideas and see where that goes. And then the next stop will be my first planned sign of the 12 which is Aries. And on that note, at 5:06 p.m. on the 22nd of July, I leave you for now.